This evening's Dhamma talk is going to be on Kammaha, or Karmaha. It's going to be, maybe better to say, it's going to be on some aspects of Kamma or Karma, because this is a very vast topic. Yeah. We could be talking about this probably for a long, long, long time. So some certain aspects of Kamma I'm going to talk about today. Yeah. And this word Kamma actually means, you probably, most of you know already, it means action in the Pali language. You also have the word karma from Sanskrit, which is basically the same word, also means action. And karma, the law of karma, or karma, is basically about how the actions we do in this life, how the actions we do today, how that influences our own future. And by influencing the future, I mean what we experience in the future in terms of pleasure and pain. Basically, that's what it comes down to. That's what karma is all about. I want to start off by telling a short story, which very likely you've heard before, because it's quite a well-known story. I'm sure Ajahn Brahm has told it here before. But I'll tell it anyway, because it illustrates a little bit the importance of karma in Buddhism, in the spiritual life, and how often, how counterintuitive some of these things can be when looked at from a Buddhist perspective. And this story is the story of the Dalai Lama, who was touring a very poor district somewhere. I can't remember where it was. And he was wandering around, and while he was wandering around, he was receiving all these gifts. And remember, this is a very poor place, so all these poor people were giving gifts to the Dalai Lama. Now, obviously, the Dalai Lama, being a head of state, being the head of a religion in Tibet, is not a person who actually has needs very much. He's already in a pretty good position. And yet, he was receiving all these gifts from all these poor people. And at this time, there was apparently a Western reporter touring together with the Dalai Lama. And he saw all these poor people giving gifts to the Dalai Lama. And after a while, he started wondering, is this right? Is this correct? Why is he receiving all these gifts from all these poor people? Surely, this cannot be correct. This can't be the right way of doing things. And then there came a point when a small girl had a skirt, and she wanted to give this skirt to the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama accepted that skirt. And at this point, this Western reporter thought, this is going too far. Surely, this cannot be right. So he went up to Dalai Lama to confront him. And he said, how can you justify this? How can you justify accepting a skirt from this dirt poor girl who probably has a hard enough time just getting anything to eat? And of course, Dalai Lama's answer was, she needed to give that skirt. It wasn't that I need the skirt. It was that she actually needs to give it. And this is just to point out to how powerful these sort of actions are considered in Buddhism, because the kind of happiness, the kind of goodness you can get, you can feel from doing a kind act like that, like giving a skirt, something which was obviously very dear to her, wasn't needed by the Dalai Lama. Even that act, because you're sacrificing something, you're giving something, can be very, very powerful. And this was what he was saying here. So this becomes then a very important part of the Buddhist teachings, this doing of good karma, doing of good actions, because it can create so much happiness and so much goodness for us. Now, the giving of something material, like giving a skirt, is in Buddhism a fairly small thing. The Buddha always graduated good karma, or what he also called merit-making. He graduated into three particular steps. And the lowest of those steps is actually generosity, giving. The next step higher up is virtue. And this is something very important to realize, that virtue is actually much more powerful good karma than generosity. I'll get back to this later on. And the final and the most powerful of these good karmas is called bhavana, or development in Pali language. And this essentially means development of the mind, and relates mostly to meditation practice. So these are the three steps of making good karma in Buddhism. And I'll talk more about those later on. But before I go on to talk in more detail about some of the more complicated aspects of this, I just want to briefly review some of the basics of karma. And karma, action, The way we decide whether something is good karma or whether something is bad karma is always by looking at the intention that goes with that particular action. So it's the intention which tells us the quality of the action. So if the intention is good, the action is good. If the intention is bad, then the action is bad. That's how the law of karma basically works. So intention is basically the same as karma here. And bad intention means intentions of greed, intentions of anger or hatred, and intentions of delusion. So these are like the motivation, the thing which lies behind the actions that we do. And good karma is always karma which comes from generosity, the opposite, or non-desire, if you like. Action which comes from loving-kindness and compassion, the opposite of anger and ill-will. And actions which are derived, motivated by wisdom. These are the good karmas in life. So this is the most basic distinction here. And anything we do that is based on these wholesome, these good roots, that is going to be good karma. And it's going to be out to our own benefit, and obviously also to the benefit of others as we go through our lives. So essentially what we want to do, we want to move ourselves away from these bad karmas, these unwholesome motivation intentions, towards the good karma. This is basically what a very large part of Buddhist life is all about. Now, karma is a very powerful thing here, because karma has at least, we can divide it into three types of effects we can say about karma. And the first effect is that good karma, if we do it properly, has a positive effect on us in this very life. In this life, we feel a sense of happiness, of contentment, when we do good actions, because when we do those actions, it just feels good. It's a basic law, and I'm sure most of you are aware of that. If you do something good, there is something automatically which happens inside. The second part of good karma is that it leads to a happy abiding in the future life. So if you want to go to a good destination in the future life, again, the path for doing that is through good karma. And finally, good karma is the first stepping stone, is the first step also in actually moving towards Nibbana, moving towards wisdom, and moving towards the highest realization in Buddhism. So karma is all these three things. And this is one of the beautiful things in Buddhism, is that there isn't like a distinction, like sometimes you can read about this, that you put all the kind of worldly things in one box, and they say, well, one practice leads to like a heavenly destination, and this is for certain people, and other people who are more advanced, well, they practice the path to Nibbana. But actually, it isn't like that, because the path is the same, whether you're practicing for a good rebirth, or you're practicing for Nibbana, it's the same direction. So, and that is the beautiful thing, because it means it's not as if you're choosing one or the other. You are going in the same way, at least for a long, long time. There comes a point, of course, where the two paths diverge a little bit, because you have to go beyond the desire for rebirth altogether. But for a long, long time on this path, they go in the same direction. That is very nice. It's very reassuring, because it takes away this sense that you have to choose. You don't have to choose. Good karma can take us all the way to enlightenment. What I want to do now, I want to take what I consider one of the classical, often quoted dilemmas in Buddhism. And I want to look at this dilemma and take it apart and see if we can get a deeper understanding of these laws of karma by looking at this particular dilemma. And this dilemma is something we often come across, particularly in the West, I find. And this is the question of where is it most good karma when it comes to generosity? Where can generosity provide the most powerful results in life? And very often in Buddhism, we are always told, well, you give to an enlightened person. If you give to an enlightened person, you can be sure it's always going to be the best karma. But then, of course, sometimes people say, but what if there is like a small child somewhere, a small child who is really suffering, who doesn't have enough to eat, who is starving, and unless we give to this little child which cannot fend for itself might die. Surely, in such a situation, it is right to give to this little child and not to give to somebody who's fully enlightened, even though they are very pure through the enlightenment. And because this enlightened person probably already has enough to eat, probably has enough support already. And I think that is a very fair question. And it's a very important question. And when we compare the kamma that you can gain from giving to a fully enlightened person, and you compare the kamma that we can get from giving to a small child who is hungry, we can actually tease out some of the aspects of what it means to make good kamma. What are the ingredients in good kamma, basically? Now, this thing we always hear, that it is better to give to somebody who's fully enlightened than to give to anybody else. Well, that is true if all other circumstances are the same. So if everything else is the same, if there is no difference between the two, apart from the fact that one is enlightened and the other one is not, well, in such a situation, certainly, it is much, 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 much more good karma to give to somebody who's fully enlightened. And the reason why it is much more good karma is because somebody who's fully enlightened is such a pure person. There's no greed, there's no desire, there's no anger, there's no delusion, there's just wisdom there, profound wisdom. And this purity of the receiver is one of the most important aspects of what makes good karma. So if you want to make good karma, one of the most important things you should look at is the purity of the receiver. And that is a very powerful and important point. But as I said, this is only the case if all other circumstances are the same. Only then is it far, 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 far more powerful to give to somebody who's fully enlightened. But all circumstances are almost never exactly the same. And in this particular case, when I talk about giving to a small child who is hungry, and the arahant, the fully enlightened person who is well fed, well, the first thing we see straight away, the difference here, is that the small child is hungry, whereas the arahant is already well fed. Now, obviously, this is a difference, and this is an important difference. And this brings us to another teaching of the Buddha. All this, by the way, comes from the Buddha's discourses. This is not something, it's not my personal opinion or anything like that. This brings us to another factor of giving at the right time, what actually makes good karma. And that is giving at the right time. This is one of the important factors when it comes to good karma. So obviously, if you see a small child that is very hungry and starving, and might even depend on you for surviving, well, that is a very good time to give. It's what you might call timely giving, giving at the right time. Whereas a fully enlightened person who has plenty of support, well, you can argue that it can still be nice to give, but it certainly isn't so urgent, it's not as important. And this then becomes one of the factors, one of the important factors in seeing what is good merit here, good karma. So straight away you can see that the karma here, it skews a little bit towards the little child, because the little child is such a timely giving for this little person. So straight away there is a skewing there of what is good karma and what is not. This is one aspect. Now, the second aspect I want to talk about, and it is a little bit related to this one, and that is, what is your mental state while you're giving? This is also extremely important. Now, this can be subdivided into many things, but one of the most important things, the Buddha said, in giving, is to give with happiness, give with joy, give with contentment, so that before you do some giving, you feel a sense of a pleasure at the thought of giving to somebody. While you're giving, you feel a sense of peace and tranquility. And after you have given, you feel joy again at the fact that you have done something good. This is important, this joyfulness. And I think that there are many people, going back to the difference again between the little girl or little child and some fully enlightened person, I think many people will actually find that it's easier and it more easily brings happiness to the mind when they can give in a place where it really is required, really is needed. It may not be true for everybody. I'm sure there's also many people who get extremely much happiness out of giving to somebody they think is fully enlightened. That's no doubt also the case. But some people might find it gives more happiness to give to a place where it is needed so badly. And this then becomes a very important factor in whether you're making good karma or not. So this is something you should always take into account. And the way to understand this, why it is such good karma to give with happiness and joy, the reason is, and there's a couple of reasons here, but the main reason is that when you give with happiness and joy, your mind, you are very mindful. You are there, you are present, because the joy is one of the factors which makes the mind mindful. You get into the present moment. When you are powerfully in the present moment, the action that you do leaves a very powerful impact on the mind, because the mind receives it so much more because of the power of the mindfulness. So when it receives it more, it means that in the future, it becomes easier to recollect this good action. And even if you don't recollect it, this action will almost come up into your mind on its own as a kind of background, in a sense, background of joy, which will be there very often. Even in future lives, that background of joy will be there because of the powerful mindfulness you had when you did that act of generosity at that particular time. So these are just two examples to show you that, yes, the purity of the person involved in giving is very important when you give, but there is more to giving than just the purity of the receiver. There is also, as I said, timeliness. There is the joy that you feel in giving. And there is also other factors that the Buddha talked about. Just to briefly maybe mention a few more factors. For example, giving respectfully. Wherever it is you give, giving respectfully is more powerful. I'm sure we can all understand why that is. It's fairly intuitive that giving respectfully is something positive and is good karma. Giving with your own hands rather than sending off something through somebody else maybe is considered better karma in Buddhism. And there is also the intention. What drives you when you give? And now I'm talking about whether, for example, it is a desire for a good rebirth, or the highest and the best intention, the Buddha said, is if you give simply for it to be like a support in your own spiritual path. If you only give with that idea, may this be a support for my own spiritual path, it's a very pure kind of giving. There's no greed there. There is no kind of anger or ill will, no delusion. It's just for the spiritual path that you're giving this. So all of these things are factors. All of these things are important. And for that reason, it's very difficult to say what exactly is the best karma. And all of these things you have to take into account. So how do you decide then, if you don't know at the end of the day where the best karma is? How do you decide? What are you supposed to do in this circumstance? And this, to answer this question, I will tell another short little story from the scriptures, from what the Buddha said. And in this particular instance, it was a Brahmin, the Brahmins of ancient India 2,500 years ago. He went to the Buddha and he wanted to challenge the Buddha a little bit. So he said to the Buddha that Master Gotama, this is what the Brahmins called the Buddha, Master Gotama. Master Gotama, I have heard that you say that gifts should only be given to you and to your disciples. Is it true that this is what you say, that gifts should only be given to you and your disciples? And the Buddha answered, no, that is not what I say. What I say is that you should give gifts wherever your heart inclines, wherever your mind inclines. That is where you should be giving gifts. And this is interesting for many reasons. Interesting because, again, it shows how Buddhism is like a universal religion. It talks about basic principles. It doesn't talk about how Buddhism can be the most wealthy and the best religion or getting most converts and all these things. It says a basic truth about reality, where your heart inclines. That is where the best merit is, irrespective of who you're giving to. Well, not irrespective, but this is a very important factor. And the reason, obviously, why this is the case is because if your mind inclines to give in a certain place, you are likely to be very mindful. You're likely to experience joy. You're likely to experience all these good qualities in the mind which make something good merit. But if you feel disinclined to give in a particular place, if you feel, I don't really want to give there, have no desire to give in this particular place, maybe even feel a sense of aversion towards giving in a particular place, then it's very difficult to get any joy. In fact, normally you have the opposite mind states. You feel bad about it. That is why when you feel no joy at giving, that is when the merit is much reduced from when you feel joy about it. So this is the reason, and this is the cause why basically you should always, what the Buddha said, the idea is give where your mind inclines, where it's natural for you, where it comes easy. and where you feel it actually works out. This is important. This doesn't mean that we should always wait around till somebody stirs our emotions, stirs our compassion, stirs our sympathy. That is not what it means. But it means that we should give where the mind inclines, and also sometimes try and see if we can incline the mind to give in places where we think it is good to give. For example, if you are a Buddhist and you think it's good to give to Buddhist causes, well, see the goodness in giving to Buddhist causes. Even though your mind is not inclined there, try to see the goodness. And then you can change your mind around, and you can actually learn the mind, teach the mind to incline to places where you think it would be good if the mind inclined to. Okay, so that is just a little bit there of, I said all this just to clarify some of the issues which I often come across. And this is one of them. And this is what I find is a slightly simplistic notion that it's always best to give to somebody who's fully enlightened. Maybe it is, but it might still be true. But the problem is that there is more to good karma than just the purity of the receiver. So now I want to move on to another aspect of karma. And this is the understanding of karma that most people have. Sometimes when I read something about, sometimes I read the newspaper and I see the word karma or karma is being used. And I realize that many people don't understand what actually is going on here, what actually it means. You see people saying, oh, that was really bad karma. And sometimes it looks like what they actually mean, oh, that was really bad luck, basically. That's the sense I get sometimes. But karma is not really about luck at all. And there are other people who have a better understanding of karma, and they say, oh, that was really bad karma. And what they mean is, I must have done a bad action in the past life to deserve this. And again, that is also a very simplistic notion of karma, that just because something bad happens to us, it must be because of a bad action we did in the past life. That, in fact, is not really how it works. And that is what I want to explain next. Why is it that as human beings, we receive sometimes suffering which is unpleasant, that we don't expect, that we even think is unfair? Why are we receiving these things? Is it due to bad actions in the past life? Why exactly do these things come about? And to understand this, we have to understand what it is that makes us human beings. Why is it that we become reborn as human beings in the first place? This is what we have to understand here. And what it is that makes us reborn as human beings is a karma in the past. Sometimes people think, well, being reborn as human beings means that you have done a fair amount of good karma and a fair amount of bad karma, and that sort of mixes up and you become a human being. Well, in fact, what the Buddha said is that is actually not quite true. The karma that makes you into a human being are actions which are mixed in the first place. So they are like grayish actions, actions where the intention is neither purely good nor purely bad, but somewhere in between. These are the actions that lead to a human rebirth. These actions then, to give you an example of what I mean by actions that are gray. Now, most of the actions that we do during our lives will be grayish kind of actions. For example, we may give something, but we may have the idea, may this be a good rebirth for me? So straight away, that action of giving is a little bit tainted by the desire for some happiness in the future. This can be related to almost any act we do in life. And the reason is because when we look into our minds, it's extremely rare that the mind is completely free from greed, completely free from anger or any kind of negativity, and completely free from delusion. There's always a little bit of these defilements left. And as long as there is a little bit of the defilements left in the mind, call them the five hindrances or whatever, there is going to be a kind of grayness to the actions that we do. The intention is somewhere neither completely pure nor completely impure, but somewhere in between. And this is the kind of action that leads to human rebirth. Now, there is an enormous scale, of course, here, and the scale is slightly biased towards the bright side for rebirth as a human being, because rebirth as a human being is considered something positive. Human beings, generally speaking, get more happiness than they get suffering. Yeah. So it is it's more white. It's a grayish, gray karma on the white side. So this is what leads us to become human beings. Now reflect on that. We have made gray karma. You make gray karma, you get gray results, right? One thing leads to the other. This is what karma is all about. You make an action which is gray, and you get a gray result in return. So this gray result you get in return is precisely a life where you can expect a kind of general kind of well-being, but sometimes you will get unfortunate things happening to you. Sometimes you will get good things happening to you within the band of common human experience. So when you have something happening in your life, sometimes it can be small things. You have some physical ailment, sickness maybe, some illness or something. Or you have maybe somebody saying something nasty to you, something uncomfortable. These things happen to people all the time. We hear things which are not so nice. Or even bigger things, like, for example, maybe you lose your job. Maybe your house gets burgled. Something which is much, much more unpleasant. All of these things are within the ordinary realm of human experience. So what it means is that these things, we have to expect these things. These things are what has to happen in our lives. Because we have done this gray action in the past, which leads us to this human existence, we have to expect these things to happen in human life. And sometimes people say, but I have done so much good karma. I have been keeping the five precepts. I have been coming to the monastery all the time and have been doing all this, doing meditation practice and everything. And still these things happen. Surely that is unfair. But the point is not fairness. The point is that you have come into existence as a human being. And this is what you can expect as a human being. You can expect that certain negative things are going to happen to you. It's not a matter of how much good karma you make. As long as you are a human being, these things will happen. Because you have created the causes in the past. So don't be surprised when something negative happens. Accept it and see it as part of human existence. If you're not too surprised, you also won't get too negative about it, and you will rather try to find a solution to the problem instead. So the next thing then is, what about individual actions? Can individual actions also have an effect in our lives? Or is it just like this mass of gray karma which brings us into this existence? And yes, individual actions can also have an effect. But the way that individual actions have an effect is quite different from the general kind of karma that we make, the general type of action that we make. If we have done something very bad in the past life, it can be a long, long, long time ago, for example, then the way that will show itself in this life is that our human existence is slightly different from other people's. For example, we will have like a short life. Somebody who dies, for example, in their 20s, it would be considered a classical example of a particular action in the past life, which now cuts short your normal lifespan. The average person lives to 75 maybe, or even 80 years old these days. So if you die at 20, something has happened there. You're not a normal human being in the ordinary karma sense. Something serious has happened to you. Or if you are poor, if you are very poor compared to other people, and that poverty lasts throughout your life, you are generally more poor. Then again, that is an example of karma from a past life, which is ripening here and now, because you are not like ordinary people. Or if you are extremely wealthy, of course, again, it's the same thing. It's the result of good karma in the past. Or if you are very popular, or you are very famous, or you are people generally look down upon you or whatever, all these extremes which go off the norm, these are the sort of things which tend to be the result of individual actions in the past, where we deviate from the norm. So that is the difference there between the sort of the mass of karma, which generally leads to rebirth, and individual actions, which lead to individual kind of characteristics in your life. And it's an important distinction. It's an important distinction because it shows us a lot about what we have to do to actually move towards a better rebirth and also move towards enlightenment. what it means is that we cannot rely, for example, on some kind of great, big, magnificent, good deed, which is going to save us for all else we do. That is not the way it works. We can't even rely on maybe 10 or 15 of these great, magnificent good deeds. What we have to do instead is that we actually have to undertake a general kindness, a general morality, a general goodness, which goes throughout all the time, through our lives. And that general goodness, general morality, that is what then will slightly, slowly but surely lift our minds up and take it away, reduce the grayness in the mind and lift it towards brighter states. And as the mind gets lifted towards brighter states, you can imagine that the grayness becomes less and less gray, becomes more and more white. Then, of course, we are preparing a mind which then can, in the future, can either take a rebirth in a more happy circumstance, in a better position, or it can be the purity of the mind, which then is the foundation, the basis for deep meditation, and then for wisdom to arise after that. So this is what it's all about. It's about creating this background of beauty, background in the mind, a mind which is generally bright. And this does not need great, magnificent efforts. It means a general, subtle virtue and kindness throughout all the time. And over the months, over the years, you will see that there is a slowly a lifting up of the mind. There's something happening there, something beautiful, something which is really wonderful. And that is when you become really interested in practicing this path to its maximum potential. So, maybe it sounds a little bit deterministic what I said before about we just have to accept what happens in our lives because we've been born as human beings. Then if something bad happens, we have to accept that. But in fact, it isn't at all deterministic. And the next thing I want to talk about now is how can we do something about the things that happen to us, the bad karma that happens to us. There's two things that we can do. The first thing is not to take the approach that, well, if something bad happens to us, we just have to accept it. We can't do anything about it. That is the wrong way to look at it. Of course, there are things we can do about it, and this is an important aspect of karma. So if you have something bad happen to you, always reflect, well, what can I do about this? Surely, maybe there's a way out of this. If we just become deterministic, and we say that whatever happens to us, well, that is the way it is, there's nothing I can do about it, well, then sure enough, it's going to keep lasting, and nothing's going to happen. So we always be positive and try to see if there's a way out of these things. And often you will find there are little things you can do to lessen that suffering. There are certain wisdom strategies, if you like, you can use to make things less bad than they already are. So never take a deterministic approach to these things. Always look for a way out. That is the wrong way of looking at karma, to just take a deterministic approach. But the second thing I want to talk about is that in this relation, is that we can actually reduce the impact of bad karma made in the past. So if something happened to us which is painful, which is the result of having done something in the past, or the result of just being a human being, we can actually do more good karma in this life. And the beauty of good karma in this life, another aspect of the beauty, is that it actually lessens the impact of suffering in this life. And this is a very, very powerful thing. And this is taught by the Buddha in the famous simile of the grain of salt. I've taught this many times before, but I find it a very powerful teaching. And what this simile says is that if you have like a lump of salt, now this lump of salt is a simile for the amount of bad karma that you have made in your life, maybe a teaspoon of salt or a lump of salt. Now if you put that lump of salt in a glass of water. Now, the water in this glass is a symbol for the amount of good karma that you have made. You put the lump of salt in the glass of water, it becomes completely undrinkable. You stir it up. And that undrinkableness, that bitter taste of that water, that is how painful our bad karma is. When we have made a small amount of good karma, but a fair amount of bad karma. Now take that exactly same amount of bad karma, the same lump of salt, and instead of putting it in a glass of water, put it in the river Ganges. This is the standard river in the discourse of the Buddha, because this is where the Buddha was living. Yeah. Put it in the river Ganges and allow it to dissolve completely in the river Ganges, and then taste the water of the river Ganges. And you will find that the taste is practically completely disappeared. Maybe if you have some very sensitive instrument, you can still measure a few molecules of salt in there. But essentially, it will be completely, completely gone. And this, the river Ganges, is then the simile for somebody who has made enormous amounts of good karma, masses of good karma. And of course, the ripening of bad karma, the ripening of negative things happening in the life, you can hardly feel them anymore. It almost disappears completely here. So this is the power then of doing good karma, or another power of doing good karma. It lessens the experience of bad things which happen in our lives. And this is important. First of all, I should say that making the whole river Ganges of good karma is very ambitious. I suspect that when the Buddha talked about that, he probably talks about a full enlightened person, an arahant or somebody like that. But even if you make like a small puddle of good karma, that already is obviously going to dissolve that taste of the salt a lot. You're not going to taste so much as you taste in the glass. So the more good karma you make, the less there is going to be of that salty taste there, and the better you're going to feel when negative things happen in your life. Okay, so that is the doing good things to overcome the negative things in life. And this becomes a very powerful reason for doing good karma. Now then the question arises, well, okay, it's all very well to talk about making good karma, but exactly how should we go about making good karma? What is the right process of going about making good karma? Now I want to go back to what the Buddha talked about, what I mentioned before, is that there is three levels mentioned in the suttas about making good karma. There is the level of generosity, there is the level of virtue, and there is the level of development of the mind, which essentially is like meditation practice. And the lowest of these levels is generosity. Virtue is much more powerful. Morality is much more powerful than generosity. And more powerful again is the development of the mind itself. So when the Buddha talked about virtue, he started off usually talking about the lowest kind of virtue, and that was usually what he said was giving to animals is considered the lowest kind of virtue. Not virtue of generosity, I should say. But the interesting thing here is that even though giving to an animal is considered like the lowest level of generosity, still it is very powerful. And the Buddha said you should never avoid a situation where you have an opportunity to give something, even to an animal. You should never let that go by, because this is a great opportunity to make merit. And the reason it is so powerful is because making good karma has this powerful multiplier effect. So if you do one good deed, even to an animal, it has tremendously much more return than the actual action you did in the first place. And sometimes it can be very easy to make good karma in this way. And I know, for example, in the monastery, after I had my meal, I often go back to my little hut in the bush to have my meal. And after I finished, there's all these animals waiting outside because they know that somebody's eating in there. They know that there's going to be some food left over very soon. So they're sort of hanging around the window sometimes and looking inside, seeing when I'm going to finish. It is very easy then for me. I can do two things. When I finish the meal, I might have a little bit of leftover food. I can either just say, okay, I want to get rid of this leftover because I need to clean my bowl, etc. So I can either just throw it out without a second thought, or I can just have the intention, may this be for the welfare and happiness of these animals out there. That is all. That is all you need to do, from doing a thoughtless action to making an action which has the great potential for being good karma. A tiny little gesture there. All you have to do is just change your mind around a little bit and say, may this be for the benefit of these beings. So that is what I try to do. And then I go back and I've thrown out the leftover food. Then I wash my bowl. And when I wash my bowl, there is still a few rice grains left in the bowl washing water. When I pour out the bowl washing water, I think, well, may this be for the benefit of the small little beings which eat these tiny little bits of food, like ants or whatever else crawly creepies which crawl under the ground. And in fact, it's interesting because the Buddha said exactly the same thing. He said that even pouring out some old dishwashing water, I guess they had dishwashing water in those days as well, 2,500 years ago. even that is a great act of good karma. So don't think that these things are not important, because they are. The smallest little things can actually be very, very wholesome and very purifying and very powerful. The next level up, said the Buddha, is generosity to ordinary human beings. Human beings which are neither immoral nor particularly moral, but somewhere in between, doing their best to get by in life, but not really having any particular idea of morality. Now this is more powerful than giving to animals, and much more powerful than giving to animals. And again, it is often we have to try to look for opportunities when we want to do something good. And I know, for example, if you have an opportunity, sometimes in Perth you can see maybe beggars on the street. And if you feel inclined to give something to a beggar, don't stop that inclination of the mind. Do that. Don't become cynical and think, they will just use it on drink or whatever. But use instead, if you feel the inclination, use that. Use an opportunity to do something good. Or if you feel cynical, maybe give them something to eat. Give them an apple or something. So at least you do something good if the inclination is there. Or very easy is that in daily life, if we have something nice that we can share with somebody else, whether it's a co-worker, it's a family member or a friend or whoever it might be, then use that opportunity whenever you have something nice you can share. And the Buddha always said to the monks, he said that, monks, whenever you have gone on alms round and you have an alms bowl of food, you should always share some of your content with your fellow monastics. If you understood the power of good karma, you would never skip a possibility of sharing the contents of your alms bowl with your fellow monastics. That's what the Buddha said. So obviously, it is a very powerful possibility. The next step up on this ladder of making good karma is to give to somebody who is virtuous. Again, this is much more powerful than giving to somebody who is just an ordinary person. Because, as I mentioned before, the purity of the receiver is one of the very important aspects in to what extent the karma that you're making is good or not. So, if you give to somebody of pure virtue, and pure virtue here means somebody, for example, who keeps the five precepts, then you are doing good. So if you want to give it to some of your fellow members here in the Buddhist society, wow, you're making lots of good karma. So I recommend that. That creates also a lot of harmony and a lot of nice goodness in a society when we treat each other in a good way. And one of those good ways of treating each other is, of course, being generous to each other, being kind to each other. The next step up on this ladder is giving to somebody who is without desires. This essentially means somebody who is a good meditator, who gets into deep meditation. Somebody who is a good meditator in deep meditation, they don't have the ordinary sensual desires that most people have. This then is even more powerful because this person, of course, is even more pure than the person who just has good morality. And now, so far, I haven't said anything which specifically applies to Buddhism. All of these things apply equally well to non-Buddhist or to anybody else. So these are very general teachings. They apply across the board. But now we get into the realm of Buddhism proper. Because from now on upwards, if you want to make even more good karma, you actually have to give to people who are on the way to enlightenment. These are the stream enterers, once returners, non-returners, and full enlightened beings. If you give to these beings, the Buddha said, well, the good karma you're making is basically immeasurable. You cannot count it. And it becomes more immeasurable the higher you go up this scale. So a full enlightened being, is the good karma you make is much more immeasurable than it is to give to somebody who is a stream enterer. So this gives you some idea of the scale here of good, making good merit, doing good actions, and how to reflect on this. And you may think, well, surely if you give to a fully enlightened being, surely there's nobody more pure than that. This is the maximum purity. So this must be the maximum kind of merit, good karma that I can make. But that, in fact, is not actually the case, because the Buddha said the maximum kind of good merit that you can make is by giving to a group. And in particular in Buddhism, we talk about giving to the Sangha as a whole, to the whole monastic community, or if you like, to give to a Buddhist cause. And why is that? And the reason is because if you give it to an individual, it's often quite easy, because certain beings can be very inspiring. You find some people who, when you look at them, you see, wow, this person doesn't seem to have much anger or desire. This is incredibly inspiring. Yeah. But when you give it to a whole group, like the Sangha, like the monks or the nuns, for example, then you are in fact giving to an ideal. You're giving to the ideal of Buddhism. You're supporting Buddhism as a kind of cause. And you're supporting all possible in the future, all possible people who gain something from Buddhism, who gain some happiness, who gain inspiration, who start practicing in a good way. You're supporting all those who gain good meditation. And you're supporting all those who also gain stages of enlightenment, essentially. So the best thing you can do is actually give something and give it to a group. Give it to the Sangha at large. Give it to a Buddhist cause more generally. That is a really powerful, the most powerful kind of giving that you can do according to the Buddha. But as I said before, just because here we have this whole scale doesn't mean that we start focusing on just giving to any particular group. We don't start focusing just on where there is maximum merit. That's the wrong way of taking it, because then it becomes a kind of greed again. You think, where can I get the maximum merit? And then you start calculating where you can get the maximum merit. And that is the wrong way of looking at it. Rather, generosity is something that should be across the board. You should always try to see the positive in giving everywhere, even to the little ants crawling outside your cootie. Even that is a good thing to do. But now, having looked at the good karma which is to be made from generosity, we come to the next stage. And this is actually something which is very important to realize. We now come to virtue, morality, goodness in a much broader sense. This is, in fact, much more powerful good karma than just generosity. I know sometimes generosity, particularly maybe sometimes in traditional Buddhist countries, generosity can often be emphasized a lot. And sometimes people forget that actually generosity is only the beginning, it's only the start. It's the first thing the Buddha taught, and then from there it takes off onto higher things. So virtue is much more powerful, much more good karma than generosity is. And the way you can understand this is that if you are virtuous, you are broadening your sense of kindness. You're broadening your sense of goodness to encompass much more than just those people that you are giving something to. Now you're providing people with a sense of security, because you don't defraud them, you don't do anything bad towards them. You're giving them a sense of that they are not threatened, because you're not going to kill them, you're not going to steal from them. They give a sense of security to them. And you're giving them essentially a kind of mental, psychological support, which is, at the end of the day, much more powerful than just the material support you give by being generous. Being generous is like a very basic thing. You have to have material support to live. But beyond that, the psychological support is much more powerful and important. So in this, one way of looking at this is that you are expanding your generosity from just material support to also a psychological support in a much broader sense. And again, as I said before, this doesn't mean that now you abandon all your generosity from before just because you have gone up one step on the ladder, you're doing goodness instead. Of course, you bring that generosity with you. In fact, I would say, if you are a good person and you practice goodness, then it is natural that even your generosity becomes more powerful, even stronger, because you have understood more of the Dhamma. You understood more of the power of these teachings. So as we move up, we actually become more better at being generous. It comes more naturally to us. Our heart becomes more open. It doesn't necessarily mean that we give more away, because how much we give away depends also on our means, and it depends on all kinds of things. But it means that our heart becomes more open. We become more, we let go much easier of our own things, whether it's our time or our energy or our material possessions, to help other people. After morality comes then development of the mind or meditation practice. And this, said the Buddha, is the highest type of making of good karma. And the next step after morality is practicing loving kindness, said the Buddha. If you can practice loving kindness in a powerful way, and this really means powerful, now we're talking about a way where you are free from the hindrances and you are really succeeding in a meditation practice, and that is an incredible amount of good merit. And you can see why that is so. Because when you practice loving kindness in this way, then you are taking away all the defilements, in particular all the anger and the hatred in your mind, but also the defilements of greed and desire. They also tend to disappear when you have lots and lots of loving kindness and compassion. Because the mind is so pure and so beautiful, you can't even be immoral anymore. You're not able to say the wrong things or do the wrong things because the mind is so pure. That is why this loving kindness meditation, when it really works, becomes so powerful. And the highest kind of merit, even beyond this, is the insight into the impermanence of all things. And now this is the highest type of merit. And this basically means that you understand the Buddha's teachings. You see how all things are impermanent. You understand the truths of suffering and non-self. And you understand what the Buddha was talking about all this time. And this, of course, the reason why this is so powerful good merit is because now there is no running back anymore. There's no turning back to becoming an ordinary person anymore. Now you become a noble one. You become somebody for whom morality is natural. It becomes part of your makeup to be a good person. You can't avoid it anymore, according to the suttas. You can still do mistakes, but they're only very temporary. And for that reason, this is the most powerful of all merit, of all good karma. So what does all this mean? Well, all this means that you now you have some ideas of how to make good merit, where you should put in your effort, what sort of mind states are important, how the power of virtue and the power of meditation. So try to use these things. Try to use these things to make the right decisions in your life about whether you should meditate or not, how you should meditate, about what sort of morality you should keep. And by doing that, you are, in a sense, forming your own future. You are creating happiness for yourself. You're creating goodness for yourself. And you will reap happiness in this life, in future lives. And you will also be moving towards Nibbana, towards enlightenment in a very powerful way. So this is the power of making good karma. And I think that is probably plenty enough. So I'm going to stop there. So maybe we can open up for some questions or anything, if anybody wants to say anything or comment or anything or question or anything I've said. Yes, Eddie. Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah, I understand your question, Eddie. And I think there's some truth to what you're saying, because I always thought that there is actually karma even in Christianity. If you many Christians will say if you do bad things, if you're a bad person, you go to hell. If you're a good person, you go to heaven. So there is some similarity there. But there are also important differences. And I think one of the most important differences is that karma, the laws of karma according to Buddhism, are just natural laws. These are just laws. They're part of the structure of the mind and the structure of the universe. This is how the universe works. It's not somebody who judges you. It's not like another being with enormous powers and says you've been bad or you've been good and therefore you deserve this. It's just the way things are. It's a law of nature. And for me at least, that is much more convincing as far as I can see. And the other thing I think is that what was I going to say now? Okay, I'm not sure. I think I lost something there. But I think there is an important important distinction there. Now, yes, the other thing I was going to say is, of course, that the Christian, God's idea of, you know, rewarding you and punishing you are pretty harsh. Because either you go to hell for eternity or you go to heaven for eternity. Yeah? Now, the laws of karma is that because you only do a finite amount of bad, you don't never can do an infinite amount of bad. Because of that, you also get a finite time in the bad destination. You only get a finite amount of suffering. Once that suffering has been exhausted, you get reborn again in a good place, like a human realm. If you are Christian, but what if you're not Christian? Does God forgive you then? Then you go. I don't know. I don't think we should get into Christian doctrine, but I think there is some important differences there. Sorry. You okay, Eddie? Okay. I think there are some similarities and some differences. Yeah, I agree. Okay. Anybody else wanna say anything? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is actually an interesting question, and it's a very complicated one. But essentially, you have to always remember that the laws of karma are individual laws, and they actually always relate to individuals. There's no such thing in Buddhism that is like, there's no such thing as group karma, that we can make karma as a group because we're careless as a group. There's no such thing as in Buddhism. So what you have to really look at in this case, you have to look at your own intentions. How do you live your own life? What are your intentions? Are you thinking, I don't care about future generations. I'm just going to do my own thing and do what is right. And even though I believe that there is such a thing as global warming, I couldn't care less. I'm going to drive a sports car and I'm going to emit maximum amount of carbon dioxide. Obviously, if you think like that, it's going to be bad karma because you lack the compassion. There is a sense of greed there. I'm going to look after myself and nobody else. But if you think, I believe this is a bad thing, and I'm going to try to live in a good way, in a wholesome way. I'm going to vote for somebody who decides they're going to tackle these questions, or I'm going to do the little I can to maybe put some input in the local community or whatever. As long as you don't have a sense of greed, but you are moving in the right direction there, and you are doing something which accords with your beliefs, then you are doing the right thing here. Essentially, here. Is that what you were asking? Yeah? Okay. Yes, sir. Yes? Yep. Yeah, that's precisely what it is. It's always a consequence of our actions. Karma means action. That's what the word actually means. And the law of karma is the linking of our actions to the results that we experience later on. That's what it is. That linkage, which is important there. There's a lawful linkage between action and result. Yes? Well, karma is not something which is fixed, right? So it's not as if as a human being you have to become an animal, you have to become anything at all. The whole point about karma is that it depends on what you make of these things. And this is the beautiful thing about karma, and that's why I talked about this tonight, because it shows you that you can largely create your own future if you understand these laws well. So whether you get reborn in the future as an animal, or whether you get reborn as in a very happy state, or whatever you do, depends on what you do in this life. So there is no cycle. There's nothing fixed about this. There's no destiny. You make your own destiny. You make your own future. And this is the beauty of this whole thing. In Buddhism, you're creating your own future for yourself, your own happiness and your own suffering. And for an animal, it's very difficult, because for an animal, Basically, an animal is in such a difficult state that it just has to wait until that bad karma which made it an animal is exhausted. And when that bad action it did in the past is exhausted, then it can get reborn again in the higher state, maybe in the human state, and it can start doing good or doing bad, whatever, and maybe progress again. This is the beautiful thing about the human state, which is so unique and so precious about it, is the fact that we have an understanding of goodness, we have an understanding of badness, and we can actually choose. We have the possibility of choosing. We have the possibility of wisdom, of understanding. Whereas an animal doesn't really have that. An animal largely has instincts. It just does whatever it does. It doesn't really create much bad karma. It doesn't create much good karma. Generally speaking, it just goes along until all its karma from the past is exhausted, and it can take a rebirth again in a different place. Okay, yeah. Anybody else want to say anything here before we call it a day here? Okay, let's pay respects to the Triple Gem.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantā abhivāde svākato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham Namami